Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 7, 2015. Economic experts from Uganda and South Sudan come together in Juba to try to figure out how to repair South Sudan's struggling economy.
The economy is like a human body. When there's a wound in the body, it doesn't heal overnight. So we are trying our best to solve the situation.
And the UN mission in South Sudan is working with government officials to try to curb crime in camps hosting displaced people.
We don't know the detail of those offenses, but we have agreed that those people who are there are South Sudanese penal law will apply to them, and that in order for this to happen, we must adhere to the application of the status of force agreement.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. As the country continues to struggle with the economic crisis that has led to a fall in the value of the South Sudan pound and shortages in basic commodities, South Sudanese officials wrapped up a two-day meeting last night with their Ugandan counterparts to seek a solution for the collapsing economy. For VOA, Mungume Devs Rakarinj reports from Juba.
Ministry of Finance officials from Uganda and South Sudan, central bank officials, business owners and academics all took part in the workshop. In all, about 150 people from Uganda and South Sudan attended this week's workshop. Vice President James Wani Iga told participants the only way to achieve economic progress in South Sudan is by reining in spending.
Our expenditure, as you have seen, has been so tremendous. And really, you will have to make not only our Minister of Finance successful, but the entire government successful. Let us curve our expenditure and spend according to budget lines.
Ding Ding Hok Yai, chairman of the organizing committee, says all the participants were asked to find ways to improve the economy. Those recommendations will be forwarded to the cabinet for consideration. Hokuyai says several strong recommendations were made, including
the use of a letter of credit system in order to subsidize essential food commodities in the country. It should be reviewed to ensure that it is fit for purpose, to ensure that the businesses that are given LCs actually bring the essential commodities for which the LCs were awarded, and we will do the review in order to ensure it works.
A letter of credit is a document from a bank guaranteeing that a seller will receive payment in full so long as certain conditions have been met. LCs are often used in international transactions. According to the Indian Ocean newsletter report, the International Monetary Fund discovered 2 months ago that some government officials were profiting from the falling value of the South Sudan pound by acquiring US dollars at the official rate of 3.1 from the central bank and selling them on the black market for as much as 10 pounds for $1. David Deng Athorbey, South Sudan's Minister of Finance, says his office is doing all it can to ensure that the economy gets back on the track.
The production of our fields depend on our bringing in fuel from North Sudan, that is in the Sudan. The Sudan, we are negotiating with them. If they give us more fuel, we increase our production. And that's what we are doing now.
Based on current reserve estimates, the World Bank expects South Sudan's oil production to reduce steadily in future years and to become negligible by the year 2035. South Sudan's GDP was $11.8 billion in 2013, but the World Bank says a prolonged conflict would impact negatively on the 2015 harvest, further reducing non-oil GDP in 2015. Athorbey says officials are concentrating on improving the country's non-oil revenues, but acknowledges that it is an immense task.
Economy is like a human body. When there's a wound in the body, it doesn't heal overnight. So we are trying our best to solve the situation. The country is being faced by the fall in oil prices. The country is being faced by the reduction of the production of oil. And therefore, it resulted to less dollars in the market. The best way for us is now to go into our gardens and produce food. And therefore, maybe in the next harvesting season, our prices will come down.
Officials did not offer a timeline as to when the recommendations will be forwarded to the cabinet, nor did they say when the Kiir administration was expected to announce new economic policies. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
South Sudanese officials and the United Nations mission in South Sudan is hosting thousands of internally displaced persons have agreed to jointly investigate crimes committed in the country's for protection of civilian sites. Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila says details are yet to be worked out, and UNMISS says the legal rights of suspects will be respected. Philip Thornaleu reports for VOA from Juba.
The alleged crimes committed at protections of civilian sites, or POCs, include rape, robbery, and even murder. No one seems to know exactly how many crimes have occurred, or which types of crime are more prevalent. So far, no suspects have been arrested for crime committed inside the POC sites. Mustafa Somar, the Deputy Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says victims of crimes at the poor sites will get their day in court.
It is important here to cite that with the minister we agreed that clearly on all those offences which are committed in UNMISS premises, we are going strictly, I say, implement the SOPA.
The United Nations Status of Post Agreement, or SOPA, is the legal framework signed between UNMISS and the government of South Sudan in August 2011. SOPA commits UNMISS to work with impartiality and integrity in fulfilling its mandate as stipulated in the Security Council Resolution 1996. In addition, UNMISS must ensure that UN personnel fully respect South Sudanese laws and regulations. There were 28 reported cases of sexual assault in the Marakal camp between January and June of this year alone, according to the Interagency Global Protection Cluster. But aid workers acknowledge the vast majority of attacks most likely go unreported. Somar met Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila on Tuesday in Juba. Wanawila says his legal team will work with their UN counterparts.
We don't know the detail of those offences, but we have agreed that those people who are there are South Sudanese penal law will apply to them, and that in order for this to happen, we must adhere to the application of a status of force agreement.
Wanawila says a joint technical committee of UN and government officials will work out more details on how to handle alleged crimes. Somar says whatever legal mechanism is agreed upon, it will not only respect the UN status of post agreement, but the South Sudanese final court.
At a certain time again, I believe the minister and I again will meet to look at the process which has been proposed and then to see how we can really move this process forward.
Somar says the government and UNMISS will ensure that the suspects will be provided appropriate legal service and their rights will not be violated. UNMISS hosts more than 100,000 civilians at its bases in Juba, Malakan, Bentiu, and Bor. The civilians fled to the camps to escape the fighting that broke out in December 2013. Many of them say they do not feel it is safe to return home. For BOA News, I'm Philip Thornaleu in Juba.
Meanwhile, in Germany, authorities are holding a summit on refugees tomorrow, as the number of people seeking asylum in the country has doubled in a year. Close to 30,000 migrants are believed to have crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Africa to Europe so far in 2015, with many heading north in hope of finding better welfare programs and jobs. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell reports.
The first migrants boarded the Verona to Munich express train at Brenner, the last stop in Italy on the mountainous Austrian border. They were mostly Somalis and Eritreans. They carried no possessions. Nervously, they made their way through the cars. Some sat in vacant seats, others waited in corridors. The first police officers came aboard at Rosenheim, just inside Germany, and began checking passports. One by one, the migrants were led off the train. After half an hour, more than 70 were lined up on the platform as the other passengers stared through the windows. Under Europe's so-called Dublin regulations, migrants are meant to apply for asylum in the country where they first arrive, so they often refuse to reveal their identity or give fingerprints until they get to their final destination, often Germany or other wealthy northern European states. Few migrants want to stay in southern Europe, explains Rebecca Killian-Mason of the Munich Refugee Council.
Like in Greece, you have huge problems, and in Greece no one is sent back to Greece at the moment because the situation is so awful. With Italy, there are still a lot of people sent back to Italy through Dublin, and that is quite problematic because a lot of people are homeless in Italy. They don't get social support.
But they do get that support in Germany. 173,000 people applied for asylum here in 2014. The rate has doubled in 2015. Among them is James from Sierra Leone. He's now living in refugee accommodation in Munich, but first set foot in Europe by illegally entering the Spanish enclave of Melilla in North Africa. He hopes the German authorities will look kindly on his asylum application.
It hurts me when I heard that maybe they're going to send me back to Spain. Sometimes it hurts me. I just don't want to think about it. Yeah, I can tell you, me being here is worth risking life for.
The huge number of asylum cases means the authorities are overwhelmed, so only a fraction of those eligible are actually returned to their country of arrival, says Franziska Fassbinder, who provides free advice to migrants through the Munich Refugee Law Clinic.
Because we have only a short time slot where they can bring this person back. This is about 6 months. And when a refugee comes to Germany, we often tell him or her just to wait.
Many asylum seekers are rejected on the grounds that they are economic migrants rather than refugees fleeing war. It is a difficult distinction, argues Fassbinder.
I would also ask the question, is it really an economic reason if I can't get any food?
Rich European nations like Germany are famous for their welfare programs and social care, but the influx of migrants fleeing both war and poverty is testing the will of governments and people across the continent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at old age and body immunity system. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What traditional role for women would you like to change?
There's so many things that I would like to be changed about traditional roles our women play. First, our women are considered part of their house properties by our men. God forbid, this thing have to change because I wouldn't like to be a property. I would like to be an equal partner to my partner.
With early marriage, especially young ladies who are still in school, I want them to continue with their education.
The traditional role I would like to change, I have the capacity to do that, is to disengage them from the kitchen because they have to take a better role in the society. We should create more awareness because they have the largest share in the population.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new study adds to growing evidence that HIV-infected people have immune systems similar to those who are much older. This occurs even when they are being treated with antiretroviral drugs. The older age immune system can make them more prone to certain diseases, as we hear from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Dr. Douglas Jabs says while HIV/AIDS patients are living longer than ever, thanks to antiretroviral drugs, they are at greater risk of developing age-related diseases. These include cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and even frailty. Jabs is the lead author of a new study that says they are also more susceptible to age-related macular degeneration, or AMD. The disease can cause vision loss and blindness in its late stages. AMD is listed as the leading cause of visual impairment and blindness in people over 65. It causes damage to part of the retina called the macula, which is responsible for clear, sharp vision. Jabs is a professor of both ophthalmology and medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York.
There's an emerging body of data in the HIV literature that patients with HIV infection who are treated with antiretroviral therapy and have immune recovery, so they're now not getting opportunistic infections, they have markedly improved survivals, still have a shortened survival relative to patients who are not HIV infected when you age match them.
He says they appear to have what's called accentuated or possibly accelerated aging.
In addition, the immunologists are showing that the immune system of patients with HIV who are treated with antiretroviral therapy and immune recovered have changes similar to the immune systems of 75-year-olds, called immunosenescence.
Dr. Jabs and his colleagues studied more than 1,800 HIV patients between the ages of 13 and 73 from 1998 to 2011. The study says their immune systems were always activated and they had chronic inflammation, a condition that's been linked to a number of health problems. In a sense, their immune systems had a lot of wear and tear.
They've had a lot of immune stimulation. They've got a lot of cells that are responding to the things that they've seen, but they're losing some of the ability to respond to new challenges. When with this immune activation, they have systemic levels of inflammation using simple biomarkers. Those pieces of information suggested that because of the accelerated aging and because of the issues related to inflammation and immunosenescence, that maybe patients who are HIV infected would have similar age-related changes in the eye. And so we decided to look for AMD.
When compared to a group of people of similar ages not infected with the AIDS virus, they had a fourfold greater prevalence of macular degeneration.
We looked at all the different drugs that they're taking. It's not related to the drugs. It's not due to the drugs at all. It is due to the beating that the immune system has taken dealing with HIV and everything else. And it's similar, by the way, to what the immune system looks like in a 75-year-old adult, except these people are all 45.
The next step, says Dr. Jabs, is to try to understand what's going on, to determine whether chronic activation of the immune system and systematic inflammation are actually the reasons for greater risk of AMD. In the meantime, he says, the message is one of vigilance. Manage diseases in HIV patients the way they would be treated in older individuals. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. More deadly violence in Burundi today has left at least three people dead and 13 others wounded as demonstrations continue against President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. Demonstrators say supporters of the government and police have been attacking them, allegations that police and the ruling party deny. Witnesses and a Red Cross official said the latest unrest occurred today after police intervened to stop clashes between the president's supporters and opponents in the capital, Bujumbura. U.S. and Saudi officials have agreed to pursue a humanitarian pause in Yemen, where fighting by Shiite Houthi rebels has forced thousands of people to flee the country. At a news conference in Riyadh today, Secretary of State John Kerry and his Saudi counterpart, Foreign Minister Abdel Al-Jubeir, said efforts were underway to forge a 5-day ceasefire in Yemen to send in humanitarian aid. And finally, nearly 100 migrants from Somalia, Egypt, and Sudan are the latest group rescued at sea by Italian crews while trying to reach Europe. Authorities say the migrants, including a dozen unaccompanied minors, arrived at an Italian port on the island of Sicily last night. The recent surge in migrants risking their lives to reach Europe has set off a debate on how to stop the exodus. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
We now turn to northeast Nigeria, where nearly 300 women, girls, and children who were rescued from Boko Haram's stronghold are starting a long road back to normal life. Christine reports from Malauki in Nigeria. I beg your pardon, we don't have the tape for that story, but we'll go straight to excerpts from our town hall meeting, which was held here in Washington last week. Today we are talking about media. It has been a rough road for journalists working in South Sudan. They have complained of harassment, beating, and detentions. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael Makwe, warned journalists this week that the country will take them to court for inaccurate reporting. In our town hall segment today, panelists Noah Gatschok of Oxfam America, former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Susan Page, civil society activist Sarah Real Keleto, and South Sudanese Ambassador to Washington Garang Ding Akwang discuss how the media have covered the peace talks. We start with comments from Noah Gatschok.
I think the role of the media is certainly absolutely essential, and I think it can always be encouraged and supported even further. There have been some difficulties with the media, as was mentioned earlier, and ability to share information, to publish. But it's really crucial, and anyone who's lived in South Sudan or visited knows the extent to which the radio in particular is important as a means of communicating information. One thing that you see when you go to many of the remote areas of the country is lack of information, misinformation, and that can be really dangerous for people to not know exactly what's happening, to misunderstand the positions of others, and can create conflicts, tensions that really bubble up and explode into something much worse. So that role of the media in terms of sharing information, sharing the positions of all the different sides involved, and communicating back is absolutely essential.
Thank you, Sarah. Your take on this?
I feel like there's always two parts of the story. But unfortunately, when we get news from back home, it seems to be one side, and there's a lot of suppression, and on the media on the ground. So the information,
journalists are not allowed.
Journalists are not allowed to do their work, and they get a lot of they are being harassed mostly. We see that the coverage, especially for us here in the diaspora, we only South Sudanese, we follow Voice of America, and the Voice of America is the only place, and John Tanza is the one who has to travel there and do all the job. But there's so many news outlets, like the CNN, it did something a little bit in the beginning when the conflict started. But I think, like the same thing when it's Syria, you see those of Anderson Cooper there, or in Ukraine or in Egypt, but there's no one in South Sudan, or in Sudan, or in some parts, other parts of Africa. But we would like to see that happen, because this is how the information will come to America, or to the U.S., or to the international community, because not everyone listens to Voice of America.
Thank you very much, yeah. And I will move forward. Ambassador Page?
I think the role of the media is critical. I think it's already been mentioned, the role of radio in particular in South Sudan. But quite frankly, the word of the grapevine is the most important thing in South Sudan, which is why it's important to get true stories out. And I think it's also important that the government talk to its own citizens directly, through local media, through its own media, but also that there is representation at the talks, but also snapshots of what people are thinking around the country. That has actually been extremely difficult. It's not just Voice of America that has had its reporters beaten up. They've been locked up. But this is also true of local and other international media outlets and individuals. It is a real problem in South Sudan, as it is in lots of places where there is conflict going on. People get afraid of the truth and what is being reported, and also the media has a responsibility to report the truth.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Kwang, the issue of the media is, they would say, your government is restricting the media from doing its work. Of course, the Minister of Information would say, no, there's freedom of press. You can say anything you want in South Sudan and nobody will touch you. How did the media cover the peace process?
Yeah, thank you very much. The media can play a very, very good role and can play also a very negative role in South Sudan conflict and in any conflict in the world. Because media is infrastructure, but is managed by people. There are mistakes that they can do, and then we say the media has done a mistake. Network has done a mistake, but it is individual. So they can, the media can define a good atmosphere in the case of South Sudan conflict. They can play very positive role in encouraging the stakeholders and informing the public about the peace process in South Sudan. This can be played by media. The media also can influence, like what we are doing here, can influence a debate, encourages the debate, like what we are doing here. This is a good role, a good example of the media. But also media can play a negative role in peace and in war. Because the principle is that bad news sells. So sensitization of the news also is there in some of the media houses, and in some personnel would also go along that line. But we want, as a government, that a credible media that will report credible news, that is what we want in South Sudan. But not the media house or personnel that goes to incite people in South Sudan. And this is what the minister is saying, and this is what everybody is saying, that don't incite. You come with a good information to the people of South Sudan. So media can play negative or positive role in South Sudan, and we encourage them not to write from Washington or from Nairobi, from anywhere. They have to go to South Sudan.
We have been listening to Garang Ding Akwang, South Sudan's ambassador to the United States, Susan Page, former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. Ambassador Page is now a senior advisor in the office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. That office provides funds for this program. We also have Sarah Kaleto-Real, founder and executive director of the Global Partnership for Peace in South Sudan, and Noah Gatchok of Oxfam America. Tomorrow in our town hall meeting segment, we will air questions and answers from the audience. You can watch the town hall by going to our website. That brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Binia Kongole by Mr. Lengs.
Chantale de Bidia, I promise. Nakumo Vitua, Anajahi Narua Sikongo, Nagabu Sura Chantale, Nadava Malile Usura, Nasabi Pe Chantale, Natosubata, Nasabi Pena, Nawelediana Chantale, I promise forever. Bina Kongolese, Analiki to Isu Chantale, Ia Jemila, Noila, Ia Jitami.
We have been listening to Mr. Lengs with the song Binia Kongole. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and cars. Please join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mwana masi ya kukule, ngana siwie kukule.